Welcome to the MS News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell, and I also have secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. I am a columnist with MS News Today at multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com. Thank you all for listening to this podcast. Let me invite you to join our MS forums. We have over 1,000 active members discussing common themes and sharing their experience on living with multiple sclerosis. Please consider joining. You can find the link to the MS News Today forums in this episode's description. Welcome to the Multiple Sclerosis News Today podcast. I am your host, Jen Powell. Joining us today is neuroimmunologist Dr. Aaron Boster. Dr. Boster is a board-certified neurologist specializing in multiple sclerosis and related central nervous system inflammatory disorders. Dr. Boster grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and attended undergraduate school at Oberlin College. He earned his MD at the University of Cincinnati College and Medicine and completed an internal medicine and residency in neurology internship at the University of Michigan. He then completed a two-year fellowship in clinical neuroimmunology at Wayne State University. Since then, Dr. Boster has been intimately involved in the care of people impacted by multiple sclerosis. He has been a principal investigator in numerous clinical trials, trained numerous multiple sclerosis doctors and nurse practitioners, and published extensively in medical journals. He lectures to MS patients and providers worldwide with the mission to educate, energize, and empower people impacted by multiple sclerosis. Dr. Boster, what an honor to have you.
I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm just very excited because one of the three things I want to point out, you do educate, energize, and empower whenever I see your YouTube channel. So
thank you.
You have quite a gift to do all three. Dr. Boster, I'd like to just start right out of the gate. I've read that you had a vision for how people should be cared for. That struck me because you don't hear that often, although people might have some kind of concept as to how people should be cared for. I'm more interested in what that vision is and how did that vision become so deeply ingrained?
My introduction to MS really predates my earliest of memories. My Uncle Mark had MS before I was born. And I grew up in a very small, tight-knit family. I spent every Shabbos at my grandparents' house where my uncle lived. And I watched my uncle deteriorate in an era before therapies were available. And so MS was part of my life before I knew it was multiple sclerosis. Learning about helping my uncle go to the bathroom or helping him transfer, these were things that were normal in my childhood. I decided to be an MS doc, bluntly, when I was 12. Not maybe for traditional reasons, but I was at my grandparents' house, and my mother and my grandmother were sitting at their kitchen table on high-top chairs, and they were holding hands, and they were crying. And they weren't crying because my uncle had MS. He had MS for a long time, and he was in the other room watching TV, which is what he did. They were crying because he had a problem, and they couldn't get a hold of their doctor. And this predates the interwebs. This predates the involvement of the National MS Society. And my family was scared and alone. And I told my mom that I was going to learn to do it better. Now, I didn't know what I was telling my mother. I didn't know that I'd go to school for a really long time or learn, you know, a bunch of weird Scrabble words or be bald by the time I finished my training. But I knew that nobody should make my family feel that scared and that alone. And mind you, my family were educated. We have means. We had desire. And so that really sent me off on a trajectory where I went to, you know, I in high school, I said, I want to be an MS doctor. And people would say, oh, you know, Jerry's kids. No, you know. And I actually sought out an undergrad so that I could do neuroscience. So one of the reasons I chose Oberlin was because they had a neuroscience undergrad. And so I was rather mission driven, if you will. During my first year of medical school, I declared that I wanted to do neurology, which is kind of a weird thing to do, but I knew what I wanted to do. And I just had a very directed course, you know, with the goal of helping families impacted by MS live their very best life despite having this condition. And I would be a fool if I didn't appreciate that those early experiences have shaped who I am as a human, and they shaped how I am as a doctor. Because I knew what it meant to have to be disimpacted long before I knew immunology. So I think that's a bit of a different perspective than maybe another neurologist. I like immunology. I really am very excited and proud that I get to be a physician, but I'm really, I really feel like I'm sort of paying something forward that was not offered to my family. And so, you know, my uncle passed in his 50s from complications of MS, and his caregivers, my grandparents, have passed on, and I can't help them, but I can help some other family. And so that's very important to me.
I can tell. I'm sorry, I'm emotional, but
it's okay. I'm a little emotional too. That's all right.
I'd venture to say that before you are a neuroimmunologist, you're an amazing human being. I feel like those two components together create a wonderful doctor for those of us with MS, for anybody. I think the frightening inability of your family not to be able to reach care and not know how to help is one of the most frightening feelings ever.
Amen. Absolutely.
I just want to let you know my heart is with you, and I am sorry you had the experience, and I am somehow blessed that you did for all of us. So
thank you.
You were formerly the assistant professor of neurology at The Ohio State University, where you headed the neuroimmunology division. And what inspired you, because you've done so much there and at, among other facilities, what inspired you to open the Boster Center for Multiple Sclerosis?
It was an evolution of sorts. So when I was in training, and I was, you know, I was training in a formal neurological manner at big institutions. And I was told repeatedly that you can't do MS care outside of a big academic center. Not possible. Can't do it. Because, you know, you need all the things that the academic center has, and you just can't do it in community practice. And so I never once thought about not being an academic. Like it was, you know, I was instructed that that's what you had to do. And so I started off as an assistant professor, pretty darn motivated to change the world. And bluntly, I was met with tremendous bureaucratic barriers. I've chosen my words to be polite because I would like to be polite. And it increasingly became very, very challenging in my desire to deliver care. And it was so much so that I started to not like what I did. I loved delivering care, but I really started to kind of not enjoy my professional life very much. I had a unique opportunity. I was offered, there's a large non-for-profit hospital system, and they were setting up a neuroscience center, and they accorded me to come over and set up their neuroimmunology for 13 hospitals. And I was scared to death to even consider it because it wasn't academic. It was a community hospital, and I really had a crisis of conscience. And I went to, you know, all of my advisors, and, you know, and they encouraged me. They said, you know, you can probably do it, even though it's not academic. And I took the plunge, and it turns out that you don't need to be an academic to do high-level tertiary neuroimmunology. That turned out not to be the case. And I found myself in this amazing, it was probably the most for-profit, non-for-profit environment that one could imagine, but it would be, you know, a bunch of hospitals. And it was really exciting. And I had an opportunity to develop a dream of mine of developing a interdisciplinary approach. And that was a really exciting time. fast forward after this center was constructed and was running, and as a systems chief in this hospital, I was increasingly being asked to do less and less neuroimmunology and patient care, and more administrative stuff, supervising infusion centers and just various things that were taking me away from what I wanted to be doing, which was delivering care to families with MS and doing MS clinical research. And so I again thought, well, gosh, I wonder if I don't need a system, you know, I'm not getting any, younger. And I decided that I really wanted to provide care in my hometown. And so I partnered up with a buddy of mine, a business guy, and we decided that we were going to start a clinic, which, you know, is a, maybe a weird thing to decide to do, but what the, we're going to set up an MS center. And we put together our best efforts. It took several months, took nearly a year to get everything constructed because we were starting from nothing. I can tell you some funny conversations when I would call like a prospective bank or prospective lawyers, and they would say, oh, no, doctors don't do that anymore. You know, well, who are your backers? Who are your partners? Not just me. At any rate, we launched the Boston Center for MS March 18th of 2020, 2 days before the governor of Ohio saw fit to close the state. So you can only imagine, the experience that we all had. And despite that little hurdle, the Boston Center is now just over 3 years old, and I'm so proud of my team. We're caring for about 1,400 families, mostly from Central Ohio with MS. We're very actively enrolling for 10, 11 clinical trials right now. And in this evolution, what I learned was not only did I not need an academic center, I didn't need a system. I don't need a system at all. I can provide the care that I think I want to deliver with a core team of brilliant people. And I'm really, really proud of that. That's a labor of love. And now I don't have bureaucrats telling me that I have to see a patient faster or that I can't meet someone on a Saturday because the nurses union won't allow it or, you know, whatever. The barriers now are simply trying to figure out how to help someone live their very best life. And so that feels really good to me. And that's kind of how things got kicked off.
An auspicious date to start, needless to say, but my congratulations. I have witnessed some of your news talks about the Boston Center and am very fascinated with the multidisciplinary approach and modalities you offer there.
Yeah.
Simply going about MS, you're treating the family and the unit that gets affected. Yeah. And to that extent, you often say, and when reading about the Boston Center with MS, with a patient and family first model, can you explain what this is and what differentiates this from traditional treatment centers, which we're not downplaying, but we're merely differentiating?
Absolutely. And to your point, we're very blessed here in Central Ohio because there are many outstanding places that deliver MS care. So I appreciate you saying that. I think, again, if we go back to the reason that I got into this, it wasn't because my uncle didn't have a doctor. It's because my family didn't have support. And I learned from a very young age, you don't get to have MS by yourself. It's not, you don't get to. My grandfather was a writer. I mean, he was an editor at Harper and Row, but he was the best medical assistant on planet Earth. And he could change out a suprapubic catheter, and he could do things that when, you know, he could set up an IV. I mean, and to think that he didn't have multiple sclerosis is nonsense. The home, they changed the home and they made the walls 8 feet wide, you know, so that my uncle's wheelchair could get through. And, his room looked like a hospital room, you know, the family is at the core. So it's not always exactly like that, but sometimes when I'm seeing a family, if the patient is a husband and he's with his wife, sometimes the husband doesn't really need me that day. The wife does. because something's going on with the MS, which is massively impacting her, and to not appreciate that is not fair. It's not, and it's also to miss the point. So I tell people, yeah, I'm not going to violate HIPAA, but I do not view you, sir, as the unit of measure. I view your family as the unit of measure. Now, every patient in my practice has my cell phone, and I insist that the primary support team has my cell phone, because sometimes you got to rat them out, you know, and sometimes we need to focus our attention not on the human who happens to have MS, but on the kids. And so I really feel like if you place this family in the center of the decision making, you almost always make the right decision. Back when I was educating residents and fellows and medical students, it struck me that a young aspiring doctor would present a case and they would say a plan. And then I would say, well, if that was your dad, what would you do? And then they would give me a different answer. I said, wait a second.
That's my doctor.
That guy is somebody's dad, right? Yes. So if you're going to do that for your father, why wouldn't you do it for his father? Like, and I really think, as simple as that sounds, it's a guiding light for making the right treatment decision. And so I think it's with that philosophy or ethos, if you will, that the Boster Center does what we do. And if you put the family in the center of the decision, then you just move heaven and earth to make sure that that happens. And that's the way I think it should be done, or at least that's the way I like to do it. And it's what feels right to me.
It feels right to me, and it feels right to many who have multiple sclerosis and their families, as evidenced by the myriad of support need out there, that where people go to tangential areas to get support rather than be able to get it in one area.
And then, you know, to thank you for saying that, and to take that a step further, it's a fool of a doctor who thinks that they can treat a complex neuroimmunologic condition like MS with a shot or a pill or an infusion alone. That's nonsense. And I'm not suggesting that allopathic medicine is not important, because I think it's really important, but it's one of the many things. You know, I have a cutesy saying that I want you to be five for five in your fight against MS. And
I know that.
And it's just a way of, nice. And it's a way of reminding us, you know, of the things that we need to be doing to live our best life. And I'll go through them with you real quick, but I want to point out that only one of them is medicine, right? Four of them are not, and they're all important. You know, exercising as part of your lifestyle is number one, because I think exercise is probably the least appreciated disease-modifying therapy. And when I say exercise is part of your lifestyle, what I mean by that is, very specifically crafted sentence, when you do something as part of your lifestyle, you're not rewarded when you do it, and you're not punished when you don't do it. So I use the example, I have a lifestyle of shower. It's just something that I do in the mornings. I don't tweet about it. You know, I don't like, hey, I had a really awesome shower, I washed my hair. That's not something I do. And if I didn't have a chance to shower, let's say I woke up late, hypothetically, I would just shower when I got home, right? And so that's showering as part of my lifestyle. And I need exercise to be like that. And time and time again, people that embrace that come back to me shocked at how much better their energy is, how much better their mood is, how much better sex is, how much less frequently they're falling, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, that's one of the very important things. And number two is to eat smart. And, you know, I really, it bothers me when doctors say that you can't change a disease course by food, because it's false. You know, and any one of us that have studied MS understand that, for example, supplementing low levels of vitamin D is a really impactful thing. And when I look at the data, I'm still a very firm believer that lower levels of vitamin D correlate with bad things, and higher levels of vitamin D correlate with a lot of good things. And of course, it goes way beyond that. When we start to remove processed foods and remove simple sugars, and we start to focus on proteins and healthy fats, when we up our water game, and when we avoid diet sodas and stuff like that, something transformative happens to the human being. Not only are they more fit and they lose some weight and all those kind of very nice things, but it slows their disease down, in my opinion. And I can't prove that to you, but anecdotally, boy, I feel that and I believe that. And so number two is to eat smart and to supplement vitamin D. Number three is to not smoke stuff. And I am a medical marijuana recommender here in the great state of Ohio, but I don't want you to light a carbon-based something on fire and then suck in the smoke, whether that be tobacco or cannabis, because it's uber pro-inflammatory, not just to your blood vessels and your lungs, but to the noggin. And it's probably one of the most impactful things that you can do to slow your MS down is to quit smoking. You know, the impact is arguably slowing things down by almost 50%, which beats the pants off some of the early MS medicines, if you will. And to take it a step further, it turns out that any cardiovascular risk factor that goes unchecked, whether that be morbid obesity or uncontrolled diabetes or high blood pressure or what have you, that has a negative impact on the aging of the brain and it speeds up disease. And so we want to make sure that we're attending to that. Number four is mindfulness. And I'm going to gander that neither you nor I really heard very much about mindfulness when we were growing up. Like that was not a term. And nowadays, I'm delighted. They actually, I think, talk about this in schools and stuff. But, you know, mindfulness, I'll just remind us, is defined, at least I define it, as being in the present moment without prejudice, meaning I'm doing something and I'm not telling myself a scary movie in my mind about what might happen. And I'm not lamenting about something I forgot to do. And so being mindful in Western culture is not normal, actually. On the contrary, if you can drive a car and eat a cheeseburger and talk on the phone, well, then good job, sister. You're being efficient. But the reality is that's a great way to feel disconnected and to miss out on life and to worsen social isolation and to worsen depression, which are very, very big concerns in the setting of MS. I like to joke that if you're having sex and you're thinking about work, you're not doing it right because that's not mindful. So you need to be thinking about the activity during the activity. I cultivated at the very beginning of the pandemic an aspect that I've incorporated into my daily life. I share that I have a lifestyle of showering. Well, I added 15 minutes to it. I sit in my shower floor with my legs crossed and I sit under the water and I breathe and I'm quiet. And at first I was really bad at it. So I would say like, Boster, get up, go to work. You know, like, and my mind would race. I've trained myself to let all those things go. And I hit a steady state where I'm just breathing for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And I have to tell you, Jen, I stand up and I am ready to conquer the day. It's weirdly transformative. Now, I don't think like you need to necessarily do that, but there's a gazillion ways to practice mindfulness. And I think incorporating that into the daily life of someone impacted by MS is really, really important. Now, that was four. Number five, in my opinion, is to take the most effective medicine that you're comfortable taking and make sure it's working. And again, I crafted that sentence very, very carefully because the most effective medicine that you're comfortable with might not be, objectively speaking, the most effective medicine. But again, that's not how we pick medicines. It's a marriage. And so if the most effective medicine is a mid-tier or whatever, if that's the one that you're comfortable taking, giddy up, let's do that. And so my point in sharing all this five for five business is simply that I think it's very foolish to give someone a pill and then, you know, see the next patient if the goal is to help them live their best life. It takes more than that. It takes a village. And I want to be a village member. I want to be a participant in that process. And so those are the kind of things that I want to bring to the table.
I'm sitting here as you went through each of the five, checking myself, and you are absolutely spot on. And as someone with advanced disease and someone who did not eat well and did not exercise and was hard on myself and have changed now to more, I'm starting late, but darn it, I'm starting. But as someone who absolutely practices mindfulness, I will say yes to all of those.
That's awesome.
Every
day. You honor me.
Well, I you honor me. I want to tell everyone, listen, please listen. Earlier in your disease, listen. It will help. Anytime in your disease, start. Don't say it's too late and don't say it's too early. Just be present. And I'm going to tell you, they all make it. Yes, yes, yes.
It's funny, you know, because I realized at some point that I wasn't practicing what I was preaching. And it reminds me, you know, there's a story of Gandhi, and I don't know if it actually happened or not, but I'll just tell the quick story, where a mother brought a young boy to see this bodhisattva, and they said, you know, please help him. He eats too much sugar. And they said, well, come back in 2 weeks. So the mother was confused and left and came back in 2 weeks and sat down and said, now I'm ready to talk to your son about not eating sugar. And she said, but may I ask why the 2 weeks? He said, I had to quit eating sugar first. Now I did it backwards, but you know, I embraced the lifestyle that I just mentioned to you. And I got rid of my desk. I have a walking treadmill desk. I practice mindfulness now. I've cut out I used to live on diet sodas and things like that. And so this is something which helps me feel better too. And I think, you know, if I'm going to ask you to do that, I better try to do it too. So I'm right there with you.
Well, and on one more point to that, I want to let people know that mindfulness doesn't mean you have to levitate. And
No. When
you exercise, for me, it's making sure I'm consistent with my dogs, that I walk up and down stairs. It's make it work for you so you create a success pattern.
100%.
I create a mantra at the beginning of my day. I don't sleep well, I have pain. But whatever that I'm feeling, I create the opposite of that mantra to help me stay centered throughout the day.
Love it.
My pain detracts me. It will be something positive on my legs. I'll say, your legs are beautiful. Mm-hmm. Your legs keep you walking. Your legs, something. And then I'll sit quietly for 5 minutes about that. So
that's brilliant.
Everybody to just listen. Wise words. Dr. Boster, what do you see as a game changer? Or there are so many, I know, but one of the major one or two game changers on the horizon for people with MS. And I know it's difficult because we're talking about relapsing and progressive, secondary progressive, clinically isolated. But as a whole, what do you see on the horizon?
Let me share three things that I think risk being transformative. So one will be a philosophy of treatment, one will be a new diagnostic endeavor, and one will be a new therapeutic option. So philosophically, I think that's where the biggest changes come, is in the philosophy of treatment. And I grew up in an era where I was taught the escalation model of starting people out on low efficacy medicines, and then if it works out, great, and if not, then we'll upgrade. And that's a terribly flawed model. It's very upsetting to me. And I think that the world, meaning the community of MS treaters, are starting to recognize that. And we're starting to recognize what colleagues in oncology and rheumatology and infectious disease figured out 20 years ago, that the earliest applications of the most effective treatments are really how you're going to win the day. And that philosophical change to me is extremely valuable. And I think that actually has a larger impact on the world of MS than anything else I could possibly think of. So I'm very, very excited about that. And there's a lot to unpack there, but just in the spirit of time, that's one. As it relates to diagnosis, right now, most of what we do is a little bit arcane. We take a careful history, we do a neurological examination, and we get an MRI. Now, the MRI is very, very important. It's changed how we diagnose MS. It's changed how we monitor MS. And yet it has massive limitations in what as a biomarker. And so there's a tremendous effort now to develop blood biomarkers. And we're so close, I can taste them. So there's things like neurofilament light and GFAP, these blood tests, which inform us about disease activity, response to therapy. I mean, it's really very, very exciting. And it's not prime time yet, but it's getting really close. And so well within, I think, the next 5 years, we're going to be able to get a blood test. I'm envisioning in my mind quarterly to help guide our decision making. And that's super impactful. Now, it's not going to help diagnose MS per se, but it's going to help us monitor, prognosticate, and assess in the setting of MS. And so in my mind, that's a real, really big deal. And it is complementary to what we currently have. It doesn't replace it. It's going to make things, you know, it's an and, not a but. Now, the third area is really in the therapeutic realm, and it has to do with bringing new therapeutic options to the table. And so right now, I'm very involved in several clinical trials, as are many, many MS neurologists throughout the world, studying routine tyrosine kinase inhibitors, BTK inhibitors. And these are cute little pills that have been used now to treat cancers for some time. So they're not like new pills, but they're new in the setting of MS. And they bring some things to the table mechanistically that I'm very excited about. So number one, they block B cell signaling without murder. So there's a lot of B cell medicines that are extremely effective. You know, so ocrelizumab, ofatumumab, these are exciting medicines, but they suppress the B cells and there's an associated risk of infection. These BTK molecules, they block B cell signaling without murder. And so there's not as much of an increased risk of infection. Now, that's important, but as we talk, and we're still technically in a pandemic, that's a really big deal. Now, the second thing with these BTK inhibitors that gets me all riled up is the fact that they can do something we've never been able to do. They can cross into the central compartment in the holiest of holies, and they can identify and turn off a part of the immune system we've never been able to reach. So part of the immune system called the innate immune system is not something that you hear a lot of talk about because we've never been able to get to it. And there are these innate immune cells that live in the noggin called microglia. And in MS, they misbehave something fierce. And so this is the first therapeutic that can really go in and turn them off. And so I'm very excited about that. Absolutely.
I love that. I've, you know, been reading about all three. I'm a self-described nerd. I spend a lot of time, and I too am hopeful about all of those. As someone with very low immunoglobulins due to long-term rituximab, I am especially excited about not murdering anything.
Yep. I'm right there with you.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about River. Tell me about River and the part. Oh, am I going to meet River? Oh, hello. I want the world to know River, even though this will be an audio-only podcast. I'm looking at River right now. Tell me about River.
With great pleasure. So River is the love of my life. Hi, baby girl.
Oh, my goodness.
And so she's an American Mastiff, and she's 8 years old now. Now, for the majority of my career, the first 15 years at least, I worked in these big hospital systems, and you're not allowed to bring your dog to work. And I used to always joke that if I could bring my dog to work, I would be the happiest man on earth. And I do, and I am. And so River spends more time with me than any other living creature because she sleeps in bed with me. She goes to work in the car with me, and she accompanies me at work every day. And River is an amazing creature who has helped me so much. And I think she helps families too. So we go into rooms together. And if you have to talk about something as unpleasant as a chronic incurable neuroimmunologic condition, I want you to be able to pet my dog while you do it. You know, my clinic is in the forest. And so all the windows look out over the Ohio forest. And, you know, you can say what you want about the Midwest, but our forests are gorgeous. And so to sit looking at the forest and petting my dog is the right environment to talk about how to beat this disease. You know, there's been many times where someone's pretty darn anxious about a treatment or an infusion, as you can only imagine. And despite all of our cajoling, we can't get them to calm down. We just bring River in, and she's really, really good at that. And so it's a gift to me. I'll tell you a funny story. When we leased the building that I'm in, it was a office building. It is an office building. And so we kind of, you know, retrofitted it. And in the lease, there's no pets. And I said, oh, yeah, no, absolutely no pets, except for therapy dogs, service animals, and emotional support dogs for patients and staff. And I kind of snuck that in there, and I locked in a 10-year lease. And so she's a very important part of my life. And I'll tell you something funny. Every once in a while, she stays at home. Like if my kids are at home or something, she may stay at home every once in a while. Invariably, my patients and their families are mad at me because they said, we didn't really want to see you. We wanted to see the dog. We even brought the dog a treat. You know, so it's really fantastic. I'm very, very fortunate that I get to have her there.
Well, so are your patients. As someone who works with dog rescue and loves dogs, I too have a therapeutic relationship, but just the love and the healing there is just astounding. So thank you.
I'm of the strong opinion that everyone with MS should have a dog. Now, I may upset some cat lovers, and I have a cat, and I think cats are very lovely. But I really feel rather passionately that you live a better life if you have a dog. Right. And that's just my opinion, but I really do feel that way.
I agree. I have a 13 and a half year old and a 1.5-year-old. And taking care of a senior and a puppy with MS, it's a challenge, but it's one I wouldn't trade for the world. So I'm coming to meet River because my family is in Westerville.
So wonderful. Well, my clinic is 15 minutes away. My clinic is 15 minutes. Yay. Well, I will.
I'm a Buckeye.
I will wait. Yay. That's awesome. OH.
You bet. How can people get in touch and find out more about the Boster Center for MS?
Absolutely. So we have a website. It's really easy. It's bostermms.com. So B as in boy, OSTERMS.com. And so that's a great place to learn about us. And if you go there, we have a newsletter once a month called the Boster Corner. And so right on the front of the webpage, you could sign up for that. And we'll send you a monthly update about what's new in the MS world, what's new at our center, what clinical trials are available. It also lists out all of my public speaking. So if you wanted to try to find me, then the newsletter is like a way to do that. I also have a YouTube channel. And so that's my name, Aaron Boster, MD. And I'm pretty committed to producing YouTube content, educational content. So you can find me there. And I read every comment that's posted always. I always will. And I do a video like once a week. And then I do a live stream once a month. And so on the live streams, that's a really fun opportunity for me to interact with people, and you can jump on and we have conversations and stuff. Other social media outlets, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. LinkedIn. That was the one I was forgetting. And it's just my name, Aaron Boster, MD. So those are places where you can find me for sure.
I'd like to talk more about your YouTube channel. YouTube is hugely important, and I think you reach so many people. Okay.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you saying that. You know, I started in YouTube in a very weird manner. I was training a fellow in MS, an amazing young man named Max Carraro, who's now doing MS down in North Carolina. And we had a no-show. Someone didn't show up to clinic, and I was kind of sassy about it. And so I was planning on talking to that person about the multiple sclerosis severity score, you know, that's rainbow thing. And so I just gave my fellow my phone. I said, hold this. I'm just going to say what I was going to say in the phone. And so I just literally just like Ray Charles bit. And I just kind of like talked about it for a bit. And then I uploaded it onto YouTube, and I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, those videos are some of the most cringeworthy content on the interwebs, but I started where every time I had a no-show, I would make a video. And then I kind of got into it a little bit. And so I started to pay attention, and I realized, oh, my sound's horrible. Oh, my lighting's horrible. And I started to get interested in like using YouTube as a communication tool. And where it very quickly evolved was as an educational moment where I was trying to help educate my clinic patients in between clinic visits. And my thought was a simple one. I see you at a given set time that I set for you. So you may see the doctor this half an hour for whatever. And I have things that I want to tell you. But you may not be in a good position to hear what I have to say at that moment. And that's a problem, because in MS neurology, we attempt to help you by request. I ask you to do something. I don't anesthetize you and cut out the MS and sew you back up. I, for example, would ask someone not to smoke cigarettes. Well, if I don't explain why you shouldn't smoke cigarettes, you're very unlikely to do it. However, if I can explain the rationale, you might do it for me. And so YouTube became an opportunity for me to convey like a message in a format that I would hope then you could absorb whenever it is that you wanted to. And so that's where things started. And frankly, that was in like 2015. And I've been making a Monday morning YouTube video every week ever since. And it's become a passion of mine, if I'm honest. I really enjoy.
I want to bring that to people. You can tell you're passionate.
Well, thank you. That's what, you know, the thing that I never, ever anticipated, which was the most beautiful thing, was I didn't realize that there's a community attached to the channel. And I didn't know about that. But, you know, there's a community of people and they're dear to me. And most of them I've never met. Some of them are in New Zealand and some of them are in, exotic places like Chicago or what have you. And they consistently show up and leave comments, and they consistently show up on the live streams. And it's a community that supports each other and supports me. And it's the most beautiful thing. I mean, there's nothing more wonderful than jumping on a live stream on a Wednesday night and having two people from different parts of the world share a commonality while we're talking. I mean, and so I really love it. And it's something that's special to me. And so, you know, as long as people keep watching, I'm going to keep making these videos.
Well, and I want to bring to people, I mean, I work in the MS, what do you want to say? The greater MS community. However, I'm a patient and these videos help me. Because is there a library of them? So let's say I'm coping with an issue that I just discussed with my physician, or I'm having my 5,800th night of insomnia and I want to learn something about it. I can go through your videos and educate myself, and I can hear in your voice that you care, you're knowledgeable, and you're passionate about helping. And when you find somebody like that, you feel better. You just feel better.
And thank you.
Knowledge is a bonus.
That's a gift to me. And thank you for that. You know, in the Jewish faith, there's a concept of a mitzvah. You know, that's like when you walk an old lady across the street, that's a mitzvah, you're a good boy. And there's an opportunity to do something called a double mitzvah, where you do something nice for someone, but they can't pay you back. And so this is really an opportunity for a double mitzvah. Because I don't know who it's going to reach. I mean, to be very honest with you, my dog and I sit and stare at my phone and I just talk into my phone and I don't really know what happens afterwards. But to get to hear some feedback that like somebody somewhere else really benefited from it is very, very special to me. So thank you for saying that. One thing I want to say almost as a disclaimer is my educational input does not replace the doctor's or a clinician's opinion, and that it's truly intended to energize and empower and educate so that you can then go have a meaningful conversation with your clinician, or so that you can not be so scared. I don't want someone to think that would replace like care. It's intended to enhance and to enrich it really.
That's what it does. And I double down on that because it has brought me interesting concept to bring to my doctor. And yes, it's always very important to speak to your physician about your specific needs and utilize anything on the internet as an addendum, not a replacement for care. But you happen to have a gift, and it's something that has brought myself many smiles too, which are somehow sometimes hard to find. In closing, I would love to ask you what message you would like to leave our listeners. But first, before that, I want to thank you, Dr. Boster. I can have you on for 8 more hours, but because I can't and it's late there, I need to let you go. But what message would you like to leave for our listeners?
I think if I was to leave one message, I want you to cultivate a sense of selfishness. I want you to be more selfish. If you're listening to this, I implore you, you get one brain. You get one time to live this life. And if you don't take care of an opportunity, if you're not afforded an opportunity, only you suffer. And that's not okay with me. And so I think all too often as human beings navigate healthcare, it's really easy to be marginalized and gaslit in some respects. And I want you to say something to the effect of, actually, no, doctor, that's not okay with me. I don't feel comfortable with that plan. And you can remind them that it's your brain, your body, it's your insurance money. And so I want you to be selfish. So often, particularly here in the Midwest, you know, you say, hey, how are you doing? Good, how are you? And I'll say, no. Is that a social, polite hello? Good, like in the Midwest? Or are you really doing good? And I'll tell you, honestly, Jen, 9 times out of 10, they say, actually, I'm doing really shitty, doc. And I say, okay, good. Let's start there. That's where we need to start, because we only have so much time. And so I really, if I was to give one message, I want you to be more selfish. I really do.
I love that message. It resonates not only to myself, but to our listeners who can benefit from powerfully becoming selfish in care.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Boster, and thank you again for joining us on the Multiple Sclerosis Podcast.
My pleasure. I really, really appreciate the opportunity. Maybe we get to do good again sometime.
That's going to be it, definitely, but only if I get to see more of River, because...
Deal. Done okay. Deal. Yeah, you let me know when you're in town. God bless.
I want to remind people that a link to Dr. Aaron Boster and the Boster Center to Multiple Sclerosis will be on this episode's description. Thank you for all of the listeners at MS News Today. This is the Multiple Sclerosis Podcast, and I am your host, Jen Powell. Share your thoughts on this episode through social media. You can find MS News Today on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us to keep updated on the latest news and to never miss new content and initiatives. Click the links in this episode's description.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to Multiple Sclerosis News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com.